Council members, take their seats, please, and we will get started here in a minute. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the November full council meeting. A few housekeeping items. One is we're not going to stick to the 90-minute breaks today. We're actually going to have our first break at 10 o'clock. We have coffee out, and I think it's going to be outside. We'll take a 20-minute break then. And we will get one in the afternoon, and that will be scheduled an hour after we return. For those of you who want it, there is a lunch menu program that you have on the table that's downstairs in the restaurant. I would ask people to put cell phones, et cetera, on off or silence. Today's agenda will be was put together prior to our establishing the coffee break, so some of the items subsequent to that will get pushed back a little bit, but we will try and make that up somewhere in the morning. I think one thing I wanted to make people aware of, Paul is not here today. His mother-in-law passed away over the weekend, so he is at home and will not be with us, and I'm sure that he would appreciate any condolences from members here. Doug.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I neglected to mention this to you, but we found out last week that one of our previous council members from New Hampshire, Herb Drake, passed away on Tuesday. He was 88 years old. Hearing that, talking to his son, he said it looked like he had a nice venison dinner, had a couple drinks, and then went upstairs and passed away very peacefully. And I was wondering if we could just have a moment of remembrance for Herb, who did a lot for this council over the years. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Are there any other items from council members? Okay, we will get right into the reports on recent activities. We'll start with council chair, and it's normal for the council chair to give a summary of the executive committee meeting that is in under tab one. Item number three is the executive committee report. I'm not going to go into detail on a lot of these things because we are going to get more on them during the meeting. We went through the timelines. We will get an update on that during the meeting. We had a discussion concerning the operating agreement between the council, the regional office, and the science center. Then we will get a presentation on that from George Darcy. We discussed the straw man for the council priorities. We obviously will be voting on that later during the meeting. And the straw man for the council's vision, which will come up under the Touchstone report. We worked on prioritize a list of council communication options. And again, that'll go somewhat under the Touchstone report. We discussed the language in the Herring DEIS. That will be, there are some changes being worked on to that language. They may have been completed. I'm not exactly sure at this point. We discussed the joint plans with the Mid-Atlantic Council. I think as people are aware, they had asked to get some more representation on monkfish, which we agreed to, and we have requested some additional membership on the dogfish committee, which I believe we are going to get as well. There was some a brief discussion on the budget, but we're still, I think, under a CR for that, so there was no real update. We discussed some of the work groups for the Northeast Regional Coordinating Committee and appointed some staff to one committee and Sally McGee to the working group to discuss governance implications. We approved the reappointment of SSC memberships pending discussion with them that they wanted to continue on. We reviewed a straw man for performance evaluation. And our last item was to approve some additional monkfish advisors. And that was what we covered at the executive committee. I don't know if there are any questions on that. Seeing none, we will jump on to the second, the executive director. Chris, you.
Rip, I only have two things to report. First, that the managing our nation's fisheries 3 conference that was scheduled for the fall of 2012 has now been delayed till the fall of or delayed until 2013 because of meeting conflicts. The second is that the new member training at NIMS headquarters will take place November 29th to December 1, and my understanding is that Peter, Laura, and Tom will all be attending. And that's all I have to report.
Any questions for Chris? Move along to the regional administrator, Pat.
Thank you, Rip. Starting with multi-species, 19 sectors have submitted operations plans and contracts for fishing year 2012. Those operations plans include all the previously granted exemptions and a number of new exemption requests. Sector at-sea monitoring programs, which were also required for fishing year 2012, were also received and are under review. And the sector rosters are due by December 1st. The proposed rule with the sector operations plans will likely be published in January. We published an emergency action on October 6th to extend the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder specifications for fishing year 2011. This rule maintains the current ABC and annual catch limits for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder through the end of the fishing year of 2011. On the days at sea and leasing programs, between May 1, 2011 and November 7, 2011, total leases processed 21 for the common pool, 118 for sectors. Total approved 14 for the common pool, 81 for sectors. That represented a 19 distinct permits in the common pool and 134 for sectors. The total days at sea leased were 218.61 common pool, 2,886.42 for sectors, and that's for the ACE transfers. The total pounds transferred were just over 10 million pounds. That's compared to about 9.3 million pounds the same period last year. Number of transfers, 643 as compared to 518 for the same time period last year. As you're probably aware, we published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking for a secretarial amendment for the small mesh fisheries on September 19th. This would implement annual catch limits and accountability measures for the small mesh multi-species fishery while the council continues development of Amendment 19. It's our intention that the measures considered in the secretarial amendment will be a subset of the measures currently being considered in Amendment 19. Four public meetings were held. The meetings were held in New York, New Jersey, Gloucester, Mass., and Narragansett, Rhode Island, and very few comments were received at those meetings. We are also seeking comments on potential changes to the vessel baseline regulations that restrict vessel upgrades. This is part of an effort to reduce the regulatory burden of the current vessel upgrade restrictions. To provide additional information on potential changes, and to request public comments on potential changes. We published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking on October 5th with a 60-day comment period that closes on December 5th. The notice is available on the NERO website and was mailed to all limit access permit holders in the region. Moving to herring, we're in the process of drafting a proposed rule to reduce 2012 catch limits. On November 8th, the Herring PDT review and approved the methodology that we've been using to calculate 2010 landings and discard data for herring. The preliminary estimates indicate that catch limit overages in the herring management area 1A equal about 1,880 metric tons. In 1B, the overage was approximately 1,640 metric tons. So those overages will be deducted from the 2012 specifications. Final overage amounts and resulting catch limits will be included in a proposed rule that we expect to publish sometime in December, followed by a final rule in January 2012. We had a closure of the directed fishery for Atlantic herring in Area 1B on October 1st and in Area 3 as of October 3rd. We did, however, find that there was remaining quota available in Area 3 and reopened the area from November 7th through November 9th. As of the 10th, the area was closed again. We also had a closure of the directed fishery for herring in 1A as of October 27th. Let's see. Moving to scallops and cost recovery, the cost recovery fee period for the limit access journal category scallop IFQ fishery ended on September 30th. The first round of scallop IFQ bills were sent out on November 10th for vessels that landed IFQ scallops during the 2011 fee period, which was October 1, 2010 through September 30, 2011. Of the 356 IFQ permits, 149 bills were sent. There were actually 12 bills that we did not send out because they were under $10. The total amount billed was $80,659.66. Hudson Canyon access area closed to general category scallop trips effective on November 12th. On October 28th, we published a temporary rule to implement emergency increases to the 2011 catch limits for skate. So effective November 28th, the rule increased the ACL by 23% and the total allowable landings by 56%. On protected resource issues, with respect to the petition we had to list river herring as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, we made a positive 90-day finding on that petition, indicating that the petition may be warranted, and that finding was published in the Federal Register on November 2nd. This triggers initiation of a review of the status of the species. That review will be relying heavily on the results of the ongoing stock assessment being conducted by the ASMFC and other information currently available on river herring. A determination as to whether either of the species warrants listing under the ASA is due by August 5th, 2012. Let's see. I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, we will move on to General Counsel. Gene.
I'm having trouble with my connectivity here, so we have a couple new lawsuits of interest. Oceana sued the agency in connection with Mid-Atlantic's omnibus amendment designed to address the requirements for ACLs and AMs. Some of the counts of action were similar to, causes of action were similar to what Oceana sued the agency on with respect to the groundfish FMP Amendment 16, claiming things that certain species were not included for conservation, that the monitoring of the fisheries was not sufficient to adequately monitor ACLs. This was filed just recently in October. And Joel McDonald in my office will be the lead attorney in that case. The Humane Society on October, I think it was 28th, Defenders of Wildlife and the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society filed suit challenging the 2010 biological opinions under the Endangered Species Act issued by NIMS with respect to four federally managed New England fisheries, multi-species, monkfish, dogfish, and lobsters. The plaintiffs allege that the biological opinion conclusions that these fisheries do not jeopardize the continuing existence of northern right whales are erroneous, and that NIMS should reinitiate consultations on these fisheries because entanglements of large whales and fishing gear have continued to occur since the biological opinions were issued. Plaintiffs also allege that any entanglement of whales in gear regulated in these fisheries are not authorized under the ESA or the MMPA in terms of incidental take allowances. The plaintiffs asked the court to order NIMS to reinitiate consultation on the four fisheries, find that no jeopardy findings in the biological opinions are arbitrary and capricious, and to find that NIMS continued authorization of the fisheries without MMPA and ESA authorization to incidentally take whales is arbitrary and capricious. Now, this is a fairly significant lawsuit that has been lurking for, the potential for it has been lurking for many, many years in connection with whether our management conservation measures under ESA and the MMPA are sufficient to reduce or eliminate takes of right whales, which are extremely vulnerable species in terms of their numbers. So we will have to keep a close eye on this particular lawsuit. In the challenge to Amendment 4 to the herring, to Amendment 4 of the herring fishery, the initial briefs, the reply brief of plaintiff and have been filed, and the government's brief is due this week, the reply brief, so the court will take that under consideration. This challenged a few things with respect to Amendment 4, but most notably it challenged the failure of Amendment 4 to identify river herring, shad, as species in the fishery, claiming that the measures with respect to river herring and shad are not sufficient, that they need to be part of an FMP, that monitoring needs to be improved for monitoring the bycatch or the catch of river herring and shad. Some updates with respect to the, while we are still waiting further word from the court in the Oceana challenge to Amendment 16, which was filed in the District Court, District of Columbia District Court. This, similar to the recent lawsuit that was filed with respect to the Mid-Atlantic fisheries, challenges several things, notably the failure to have specific AMs regarding sectors with respect to the species, the groundfish species, for which they receive no allocation, but there's a zero possession limit. There's a claim that the monitoring observer requirements in the groundfish fishery are not sufficient to adequately monitor the bycatch of species, to adequately monitor ACLs and ACEs in the sector fishery. We, as I've reported before, in the challenge by New Bedford and Gloucester and other fishing industry related plaintiffs, this is the case that the government prevailed on recently, a challenge to Amendment 16 in the groundfish fishery. Several groups of the plaintiffs have formed separate entities to appeal this lawsuit to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. The initial briefs by the appellants, by those that are appealing, is currently due on November 21st, and then the government has, I think, 30 days to respond to the to the initial briefs by the appellants. So I'll keep you abreast of those, of anything that happens with respect to that appeal. I think that's the significant matters of litigation that I need to report today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Gene. Any questions? Okay, we will move on to the Science Center. Frank or Jim, I don't know who's...
As usual, I'm going to pass this off to Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start by mentioning a few issues related to the survey sampling that's going on and then move on to stock assessment updates. The Delaware II is currently conducting its annual ecosystem monitoring cruise, which is primarily about doing oceanographic sampling with also some larval fish work. The Bigelow is completing the autumn bottom trawl survey, and it's using a new version of electronic data acquisition software that will allow for better sampling of different stock areas and length-based sampling of the fish. And over time, this will result in improved precision of the survey, catch at age estimates, and greater assessment precision. Some of you have participated in the MREP program, MREP. It's the Marine Resource Education Program, and the center will host one of these sessions the week of November 16th, on November 16th and 17th. And I believe Russ Brown has organized this. And the session this time will include visits to the center's net loft, the Henry Bigelow, the research vessel, and the observer program, and the age and growth unit. Then moving on to stock assessments. The stock assessment workshop working group for SARC 53, which is coming up for the stock assessments of black sea bass and Gulf of Maine cod, the working groups met in September and October, and they have written their stock assessment reports, which are still unofficial and have no official status with the agency. The those reports have just been sent out last night for peer review, And the peer review of the stock assessments will take place at a public meeting in Woods Hole the week of November the 29th, which is a Tuesday, through December the 2nd, which is Friday. And the contract with the peer reviewers indicates that these reports are due on January the 6th, so that'll be the date when we have written reports from the peer reviewers indicating what their findings and conclusions are about the acceptability of those stock assessments. So at this point, I know there's a lot of interest in the results of the Gulf of Maine cod assessment, and it's probably common knowledge that these preliminary findings are not good about the status of the stock. But I'd like just to point out that we have a peer review process that we're entering into, and we intend to follow the process completely and get a real thorough independent peer review of the assessments. And as soon as we have final conclusions from the independent reviewers, we'll make those public and complete the assessment reports, publish them as official documents. The center has also been involved with updates of summer flounder and scup. And the there's also carryover from the work that was done this summer. There was a basically an augmented groundfish PDT, which did tried to do groundfish updates using the survey index as a kind of a proxy for a stock assessment. And those results didn't turn out to be as good as people had hoped as serving as a proxy. So what ended up happening is the center, in agreement with the council and working with the groundfish PDT, were doing updates on a number of the stocks for the New England groundfish. And we're also we're switching over from the old SAW-SARC process to a new stock assessment process in 2014. And we're doing some test runs of the new process. So these updates of the New England groundfish are going to follow some of the steps in the flowchart that we've outlined for the new process. So there will be a first meeting of what we're calling an assessment oversight panel on November the 22nd to review the work that will be carried out on each of those assessment updates. And if you're here tomorrow afternoon, I'll be giving a short review of the new process and how that relates to the SAW-SARC process, which we've been using since the 80s. Moving on then to what's coming up in the spring. For SARC 54 in June of 2012, the southern New England yellowtail flounder and herring are both up for review. And we'll be also, one thing to keep on your radar is that for the recreational data, you're aware that there is a whole new methodology for collecting the recreational data called MRIP, and it's replacing MRFs. So the data will be released fairly soon for the public to use, and there's a workshop that's being planned probably in March, where a number of analysts will start looking at how to use the new data in stock assessments. So a date hasn't been set for that workshop yet, but I just wanted you to know that it's something that will probably take place in March. And then next spring and summer, the center will be again doing the assessments in the track of the groundfish stocks on George's Bank, and again the updates of the Mid-Atlantic stocks. Then for December of 2012, SARC 55 has three stocks on the agenda: Atlantic surf clam, George's Bank cod, and white hake. That completes my report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Jim? quiet group this morning. I think you're saving it all up for something later on the agenda. Chris.
Jim, I missed the dates on the MREP sessions. And also, typically MREP sessions have been invited participants. Is a session run by the Science Center open to outside participants as well?
Yeah, I'll answer that. The session that's taken place this week is MREP 200. It's the assessment session. I think many people have taken MREP 100, which is a combination of a lot of things. The MREP 200 session is the assessment version. It was surprising last week or the week before last where the session wasn't full. So there was a call that went out for suggestions for names of people who participate, and it was remarkable the number of names that we got for people who would be likely candidates to participate. So I would envision that this year there is actually planned another session in January or February. I'm not positive, but there is great interest in the sessions, both on our part to familiarize people with what the process is from the vessel to the council floor. And I think that there's a lot of interest in the industry to learn that process. So yes, it's open to the public. It has been invited guests in the past, but I think that the process will morph a little bit as interest grows in people understanding what the process is. So the sessions are tomorrow and the Wednesday. Long answer to a short question.
Okay, we'll move along to. Sorry, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize because I didn't hear the question that Frank was responding to, but I could clearly tell that was the MREP program that, as he indicated, will be starting tomorrow for 2 days in Woods Hole. And the process for participation in the program has been, to date, if you've completed the MREP 100 program, then you are eligible for what we call the 200 program. However, the interest level from the industry has been very high, and so we're starting to wave a little bit on that one because we don't presently have funding to implement MREP 100 in this calendar year in New England. We hope to do one in the Mid-Atlantic, and we will be doing another MREP 200 program in Woods Hole in April. So that list is already growing. We take approximately 15 fishermen for each course, which is really the maximum amount. I mean, when you're rotating people through the aging lab and the Bigelow, it's difficult to have your numbers get any higher than that. But I just would like to say that the Science Center has put a tremendous amount of time into presenting the program, and it really is excellent. And we would hope at some point that we would do it and have the ability to invite council members to participate as well.
Thank you. Anyone else on that? Mid-Atlantic liaison, Frank?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met in Galloway, New Jersey, in mid-October. Atlantic mackerel, squid, and butterfish, Amendment 14. The council voted to move forward with the public comment and hearings on the range of alternatives. There's three focus points in the amendment: the high uncertainty about the incidental catch of river herring and shad, the incidental catch in the ocean fisheries may be negatively impacting river herring and shad, and the overall existing federal, state, regional management framework may be insufficient to adequately cover river herring and shad stocks. The dates, I don't know if they've been set yet, but it's supposed to be taking place in December through the early part of 2012. Amendment 17 to the summer flounder scup black sea bass, the council reviewed the alternatives and voted to move forward. They'll be discussing it again at the December meeting, and also in the board for ASMFC can consider development of a complementary document to go enable either regional or state-based approach. Dogfish management measures were voted on. It was quite a lengthy discussion there. The council voted to go with the 35.6 million pounds. I won't go into too many details, and they voted to go with a 4,000-pound daily trip limit. I won't go into too many details. We'll take that up under Dogfish, I think, on Thursday. And it'll get interesting because Atlantic States did something a little different. As Jim mentioned, summer flounder. The council was informed that the good news was summer flounder had been rebuilt in 2010. However, the updated assessments predict that the fishing mortality rate will be exceeded in 2011 over fishings occurring, and there are likely to be substantial reductions in the summer flounder fishery. So the SSC is looking at that information. So congratulations, you rebuilt them, but get ready for a big cut. Other than that, on December 2nd and 3rd, Mid-Atlantic Council is holding a recreational focus group in Baltimore, Maryland. It's open to the public, and it's going to deal basic Mid-Atlantic issues and how to get recreational more involved, and it's part of their outreach programs, and that's in Baltimore on the 2nd and 3rd. And I think that was basically about it. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions for Frank? Thank you, Frank. We will move on to NOAA enforcement and VMS. If you'd like to come up, I'd like to welcome Logan Gregory. We certainly look forward to working with you on the enforcement issues, and welcome aboard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to introduce myself a little bit. I guess there's a little bit of a write-up on me in the NOAA paper out there, but basically I've been with the agency for 18-plus years. I started as an intern and became an enforcement officer. I was an enforcement officer in Florida for 2 years. Then I transferred to the Florida Keys. I worked in the Florida Keys for approximately 2 years as an agent. And then I transferred to the Northeast Division in Virginia, where I worked mostly Mid-Atlantic issues, and was promoted to assistant agent in charge and supervised District 4, which was Delaware to Virginia. And, of course, recently appointed to agent in charge here. And I'm looking forward to meeting all of you, and if some of you I have met, many of you I haven't. Looking forward to get to know you and hear and listen how we can improve our enforcement efforts. The first thing I would like to present is that we did roll out our draft enforcement priorities late last week. A copy of the priorities is available on our website. I have an extra copy here. I just have one. We're trying to cut back on printing and save a little money. So I will leave this out on the desk for anyone that's interested in looking at it. Basically, we have a 60-day comment period where we're looking for comments from councils, from industry, from all of our stakeholders as far as what you feel our priority should be based on the draft document. The first two pages are basically background information, and then page three gets into the priorities themselves. I'm not going to go through reading this. You can all read it at your leisure. But the long and the short of it is we're looking for input. I'm looking for input. I'm going to be here the entire week. If you have things you'd like specifically to talk to me about, I am going to be available, and that also goes for the individuals in the back of the room that are here. I'm here to listen and provide input where I can and answer any questions. We have our fiscal year annual report. I think we just emailed it to the council yesterday. So I apologize, it's not in your binders, but it will be in the next council meeting binders. You'll notice that we have an increase in outreach efforts, significant increase. We have new outreach liaison, Don Fry, who I'm sure most of you know or have met. He has been very, very well received by the industry, and we appreciate his efforts. I think he's helped us tremendously in giving us some information and perspective from our stakeholders in the industry. One thing of particular note in our report is the number of observer complaints that we've received in the last fiscal year. I just want to go over. We've received 95 complaints from observers. The majority of those complaints were closed out as for information only, or as an outreach type effort, just greater education of the industry that, you know, the observers are there to do a job. They're there to, they serve an important role in collecting data and information, and that data is vitally important. We did have one case recently that went to district court, and that individual was found guilty of sexual harassment of an observer. A reason I mention this is because I find it particularly important to note that this is an area where individuals could possibly get hurt, not just physically but mentally. And we will be, and we will continue to aggressively investigate these types of complaints. It should not be tolerated. It will not be tolerated. And I just want to make that particular point. We are in the process of hiring 5 new enforcement officers. I just got 3 names recently that were submitted to me for approval to be selected as enforcement officers, 2 in Gloucester, 1 in New Bedford. The other 2 positions will be 1 in Newport News, Virginia, and in Portland, Maine. Once those individuals have been selected and have accepted the positions, they will go through the necessary training, and we'll start their field training officer program. So that pretty much concludes my report. I appreciate being here, appreciate hearing from all of you, and looking forward to getting to know you and working with you for many years. And I'll turn it over to Bill, our VMS program manager.
Anybody have any questions for Logan? Vince, and then Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Logan, and welcome. Could you remind me again, for the physical assault or sexual assault on an observer, is that treated through a civil process or a criminal charge?
That particular case was a criminal case. It was handled in district court.
Thank you.
Rodney?
Thank you. Yeah, you said you received 95 complaints. Is that an increase, decrease from previous years?
I don't have that, but I could get it if folks are interested.
Do you receive complaints the other way, too, about observers, or is it mostly just observers complaining about the vessels?
Oh, we have.
You have?
Yes,
okay.
And we investigate those as well.
Okay. And the other comment I had, you mentioned the draft priorities, and I talked to Rip about this. We'll probably bring it up under the Enforcement Committee report on Thursday. Give the council a heads up. The 60-day comment period falls outside of our council meetings. So as a full council, we don't have a chance to comment on this, but we may individually. But we'll take that up under the Enforcement Committee on Thursday.
Anyone else? Bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, council members. It's good to be here. I get to talk about one of my favorite programs, VMS. First of all, I want to say I'm very pleased that Logan is the new Northeast Special Agent in charge. I think he brings some badly needed stability to OLE. And also, he served as the acting National VMS Program Manager, among other duties, for the past year in Silver Spring. So Logan's got a unique understanding of my program, its challenges, and the capabilities that this vital monitoring tool brings. The Northeast VMS team is monitoring 1,081 active vessels. Of these, there are 419 groundfish sector vessels registered to the Northeast VMS program. 38 of those are currently on a Northeast approved power down letter of exemption. There are 130 groundfish common pool vessels registered to the Northeast VMS program. 7 of those are currently on an approved power down. And we have 532 non-groundfish vessels registered to the Northeast program, 58 of which are on a power down. We reported to the Northeast region an observed error in the coordinates for the closed area 1 scallop access area. Those coordinates were recently published in a permit holder letter. These coordinates were effective August 1 as a result of changes to the essential fish habitat closed areas. And the discrepancy came to light when the new area was entered into our VTRAC monitoring system. The western boundary of the scallop access area was intended to align with the EHF boundary. However, there is an approximate quarter mile offset, resulting in a slightly smaller scallop access area than was intended. We also recommended that as a standard procedure, all area coordinates provided by the council should be carefully vetted through the Northeast region's GIS expert in the future. Our VMS contractor, Visma, out of Denmark, has announced that the new version of our VTRAC monitoring system will be rolled out next spring, and it will improve the layout of various functions and allow standard users to view more reports. Our contractor provided advanced VTRAC training recently in Silver Spring to all the regional VMS program managers and several VMS technicians. The training highlighted some features that will allow us to more effectively monitor the Northeast fleet, such as the use of alerts that can automatically increase position reporting. Last month, we received confirmation from VMS vendor SkyMate on the cause of a permanent loss of vessel position data affecting the Northeast, Southeast, and Northwest divisions of OLE. A failure of ORBCOM's Western Hemisphere switch occurred on August 20th, and normal operations were not resumed for over 13 hours. The event did not result in a total outage of SkyMate data during the period. The Northeast recorded 4,866 positions when we typically receive 8,000 positions during similar 13-hour periods. Therefore, we estimate that approximately 3,200 positions were lost. We have been looking at its impact on trip reporting. On October 27th, we noticed an unusually high number of bad position reports from 16 BoatTrax vessels, and we notified the vendor, BoatTrax. The problem was isolated to those vessels using the older Qualcomm Satellite Position Reporting System, or CASPER, which uses non-GPS technology to fix a vessel's position. We learned that BoatTrax satellite provider Qualcomm was transitioning their Ranger satellite that is part of the position calculations for non-GPS units to a newer satellite that was recently launched this past September. This planned transition was intended to be transparent to their customers. However, it wasn't. We noticed it. During this hot cutover, an unexpected issue arose whereby transponders for both satellites were broadcasting on the same frequency at the same time, and this caused the algorithm for calculating positions based on the distance between the satellites, the Earth station, and the satellite terminals to become confused. Qualcomm realized the issue in a short period of time, performed a reset on their CASPER system to clear the problem. BoatTrax puts this event in the category of a very rare event. Eventually, this issue should disappear as we phase out the older non-GPS units from the Northeast fleet. Our last VMS software rollout was effective in September, September 1. We still have several vessel owners who are out of compliance by using outdated software, and we're reaching out to each of them. We remind both SkyMate and Tron vessel owners and operators to be sure they're running the most recent software before their next trip. SkyMate owners should be running version 3.938, and that version is shown in the upper left-hand corner of their screen. And Tron owners should be running declarations version 9 and reports version 10. Finally, I anticipate the next Northeast VMS software rollout to occur in February 2012 to support declaration changes driven by Scallop Framework 23. And, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my VMS report. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we will move on to Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Vince.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman. And it's the first meeting I've been to since you've been elected, so congratulations, Mr. Chairman. Look forward to working with you. Our commission met last week in Boston, Mr. Chairman, and that's why our meeting summary is not in your briefing book. However, we did send out press releases on all the actions, and the meeting summary is posted on our website, but I'll give you some of the highlights quickly here. The herring section met and basically rolled over their specs for Area 1A for next year. Southern New England, the lobster board's been struggling with the Southern New England stock. As you recall, we've had two stock assessments on it indicating it's been depleted, and the recommendation from the technical committee had been for a five-year moratorium to respond to apparent recruitment failure in response to environmental conditions. We've taken the addendum out to public hearing. There's been quite a bit of controversy, and that addendum was additional options to include a 75% reduction in exploitation and a 50% reduction. In Boston last week, the board approved took final action on to implement a 10% reduction as a first step to initiate more comprehensive rebuilding, and that 10% will go in effect in 2013. The Striped Bass Board received an assessment update. I know this is an issue of interest to you, Mr. Chairman, and others up here. The assessment indicated that the stock update indicated the stock was not overfished and overfishing is not occurring. The spawning stock biomass is 109% of the target. And I think one of the things the assessment noted that we had a number of years of poor recruitment. 09 was estimated at 7 million fish, and 010 was 9 million fish. And just for comparison, the year class of 03 was 20 million fish. And think about those 03 fish. Those are 8-year-old, 9-year-old fish. Those are the ones that are we're seeing in the fishery. The recreational discards in 2010 had dropped 75%. From 2006, and what that's indicating is that recreational anglers are finding or seeing less fish than they were seeing before. And you and I have chatted about the confounding thing of difference between harvest, catch, and landings, but there was an addendum that we had taken out in response to concerns from folks in the Gulf of Maine about a low apparent fish abundance. And that was postponed at our summer meeting until they got the assessment update. And the Gulf of Maine states attempted to revise that addendum to consider putting in some restrictions on the harvest of striped bass, but that addendum was not accepted by the board. The next big news, I think, and a couple of folks here mentioned it, was the Menhaden Board had accepted as approved 15% maximum spawning potential threshold and a 30% maximum spawning percent target for Atlantic Menhaden. We're currently fishing at about an 8% maximum spawning potential, so this represents a significant decision to leave more menhaden in the water. In my world, Mr. Chairman, at Atlantic States, 25 or 30 letters is a big deal. We got 93,000 emails on this topic. We held 13 public hearings from Florida up through Maine. And it's been probably, you know, one of the most controversial management actions we've had to deal with since we put the cap on the Chesapeake Bay fishery. Now, what happens next is the board voted to initiate an amendment which will develop management measures to achieve the new reference points. And I think one of the things to note there is 25% of the menhaden harvest is bait harvest up and down the coast, as far up as Maine when the fish show up. So I think one of the tough issues that this amendment and the decision makers are going to have to wrestle with is applying the catch reductions that are going to have to come, whether they go across the board to all harvesters or allocated in some proportion to the reduction fishery versus the bait fishery. Gene gave his litigation update, and I just want to mention that the river herring lawsuit that was brought against the commission, also named the secretary, but that's being appealed. We received notice of an appeal a week and a half ago, and this is the lawsuit, Mr. Chairman, that not only named the commission, but it named our 15 administrative commissioners and our 15 governor-appointed commissioners. So we'll, our attorney will be working with the state's attorney generals on preparing a response to that lawsuit. The Coastal Shark Board met, and I don't know that our press release said it, but they decided to increase the dogfish quota 50% to 30 million pounds from what it had been, and they approved a 3,000-pound trip limit. And I think the board members that are here will probably give more of the rationale at later on in the week, but the basic bottom line was concerns about putting that much dogfish on the market. On personnel comment, Pat White, most people here in the room know Pat White, lobsterman from York, Maine, former council member. He received the David Hart Award from the commission in recognition of his career, lifetime career contributions to fishery management and participation in the commission process. Paul Diodati from Massachusetts was elected as our new chair. And Dr. Lewis Daniel, from Director of Marine Fisheries from North Carolina, was elected as the vice chair. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Thank you, Vince. Questions? Dr. Pierce.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add a few things. First of all, I'd like to thank Lori Steele for her contribution at the Sea Herring Section meeting. She gave a very comprehensive description of Amendment 5 that was very helpful in terms of giving the section, especially the Mid-Atlantic members of the section, a far better understanding of the nature of the amendment and its emphasis on monitoring catch. So that was greatly appreciated. Thanks to her. Regarding the striped bass addendum and no action on the addendum, I wanted to point out that the reason why the board decided to wait on addendum 3, which would have options to reduce fishing mortality and protect the spawning stock, the reason why they postponed action was they decided to wait for a benchmark assessment, which is going to be done in June 2013. And, of course, as Vince indicated, we are not overfished, and there is no overfishing. The spawning stock biomass for females is still very high, so that is very good news. Menhaden, I'll just note one thing. We had a great deal of discussion about menhaden. Notably, we had 93,000 or so expressions of interest regarding menhaden, and the focus seemed to be on the fact that with the target that was adopted for menhaden, the 30% MSP, we would have about a 37% reduction in harvest. But I made the point then, and I'll make it now, that it really equates to about a 22% reduction, which is meaningful, but not 37%. And the reason why it's not 37% is, well, it's 37% if you look at 2010 landings. 2010 landings spiked up from 2007, 8, and 9. So if you look at 2007, 8, and 9, then it's about a 22% reduction. Still significant, very meaningful to the Menhaden fishery, especially Omega that fishes that with the processing plant down in Virginia. So it was a difficult decision, but it was the right decision as far as I'm concerned. Smooth dogfish, I'll just note that even though we don't have a smooth dogfish fishery up here, it's primarily down in the Mid-Atlantic area. It is an HMS species. It is not managed by either council. It's managed through HMS. And the quota will be 715.5 metric tons, or about 1.5 million pounds. Notable about that is once it is implemented, it will represent about a 40% reduction in 2010 landings. So the smooth dogfish fishery down there will be impacted. Winter flounder, I should note that, very important stock up here in New England, certainly the Gulf of Maine, southern New England, mid-Atlantic. The Winter Flounder Board did accept the SARC 52 results regarding the assessment of winter flounder, using those results for management use. Now what the board will do is wait to see what this council does on winter flounder, southern New England, mid-Atlantic specifically, to see what the ACLs will be. Once we know what this council will do, or intends to do, then the winter, February of 2012, the board will readdress this issue and determine what sorts of actions should be taken by the states in state waters to complement what the council intends to do with that particular very important stock. And then finally, NEMAP. Frank Almeida was present at the NEMAP board meeting, a very important contributor over the years for NEMAP, which is the Northeast Area Monitoring and Assessment Program, a critical program now for the Northeast Fishery Science Center for us relative to assessments of the stock. We had a very good report provided by VIMS that really has taken the lead on this and has done a very good job working with one commercial fisherman, Jimmy Rule, on his vessel for quite a few years now. The notable thing about NEMAP is that we're in 2011, and for 2011, even though we're almost at the end of the year, this is the year when we will be in a position to determine whether or not we can use the NEMAP results for at least some of the stocks for indices of abundance, which, of course, is what we want, indices of abundance up and down the coast, inshore specifically now with NEMAP. It's a wait and see. We hope to learn fairly soon whether or not the NEMAP results can be used for that particular purpose. Hopefully they can in some instances. And I'll conclude by noting that another element of the NEMAP discussions was the fact that NEMAP, much of the funding for NEMAP comes from the research set aside from the auction, and there is a shortfall. And that continues to be a concern of ASMFC, certainly the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and should be for us. That funding for NEMAP is just not the way it should be. It's dependent upon auction fish, and often the expectations, that is the amount of money we expect to get from the auction, fall short of what is anticipated. So it's still a problem in need of that needs to be addressed, and we hope that eventually through ASMFC initiatives, perhaps even through this council, and certainly through the Northeast Fisheries Science Center own initiative, some new funding, more stable funding can be found for NEMAP, which is now a very critical component of the stock assessment process, and perhaps it'll be even more critical once we determine if NEMAP can be used for indices of abundance. And that's my add-on to Vince's presentation.
Thank you. Doug. And one other species that wasn't included in last week's meeting, but something that we've been working on throughout of October, northern shrimp. The shrimp section passed Amendment 2 to their fisheries management plan that now includes provisions for mandatory weekly reporting of all dealers to improve our data stream that we use to manage with. Also provisions for trip limits, days out of the fishery, and trap limits for trap fisheries. So it's given us more tools in the toolbox. We also received a rather bleak picture of our status of the stock after many years of not being overfished and overfishing not occurring. We have a determination of overfishing occurring and being overfished. It appears to have been primarily a result of overharvest that's occurred in the past two seasons, and hopefully with the new tools we have, we can constrain the landings more. As a result, we've had to essentially cut in half our total allowable landings from last year's level of 4,000 metric tons down to 2,000 metric tons. And, of course, as you might expect, this is going to result in a very abbreviated season, which will start January 2nd and go for 3 days. There'll be three landing days per week for this. And then the trap fishery will start February 1, and there'll be a 1,000-pound trip limit for the trap fishery on this. That's my report. If anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to bring it forward, answer them.
Thank you. Vince.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I was entirely remiss in giving my report in that my report is actually in the supplemental materials that were in front of you. So I apologize for not noticing that, and I want to publicly thank Karen Roy. I don't know how you did this, Karen, because I hadn't seen it on Friday. So good for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Seeing none, I'm going to make a command decision. We'll take the 11:15, the EFP item. We will go through that. Then we will take a break and come back. Did we miss you?
Mr. Chairman, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I'll be happy to whatever your choice is.
No, please. I'm sorry, Captain. My fault entirely. So the floor is all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I begin my presentation, I'd like to welcome Logan as well and thank Tim Donovan and Mark Michelli for holding down the fort for until you got on board. Look forward to working with you, and I think we'll do a lot of great things together. I'd also like to point out Mr. Dave Beliveau is in the audience, and he'll be presenting later on the Coast Guard's 2010 Authorization Act and its impact on fishing vessel safety. So we appreciate you coming all the way up here from D.C. as part of our headquarters work release program, Dave. And thank you. To the numbers real quickly, 491 boardings conducted since 1 September, 5 fisheries violations issued for a compliance rate of an observed compliance rate of 99%, which is a little bit higher than our last compliance rate. One of the violations I'll discuss in detail in a moment, and it had to do with impeding a Coast Guard boarding. On the safety side, those same 491 boardings, we issued 137 violations to 73 vessels, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 85.1%. So we're holding steady. On the safety front, we responded to 40 fishing vessel casualties and conducted 7 medical evacuations during the reporting period, resulting in assistance to 94 mariners. Also, I'm happy to report for the first time in a long while, no lives lost during the reporting period. We did terminate 4 voyages for safety reasons. 2 vessels, one did not have a survival craft on board. One vessel had an improper survival craft, and one vessel lacked fire extinguishers, and another had no PFDs on board. So I mentioned the impeding the Coast Guard boarding. That was part and parcel of the boarding of the fishing vessel Dinah Jane, which was conducted on the 4th of November into the 5th of November. As I reported to you at the last council meeting, Mr. Chairman, we've put an additional emphasis on space accountability at sea due to the hidden compartment we found on the Villanova to Corvo 2 back in August. Now, as you can see, you're in the galley in this set of photographs here, and it's sort of difficult to see, but the clock, if you use the clock on the fire extinguishers as a fixed point of reference, this bulkhead here is now over here, and you can see a space that is only accessible by unscrewing the wall. this vessel was on a limited access IFQ scallop trip, and during the course of the boarding, we discovered the insulated space, which measures 3 feet wide by 6.5 feet tall by 7.5 feet deep. This is probably a more detailed photo. Again, now you have the fire extinguishers here, that bag of onions, and you can see more into the space and get a sense for the depth of it and its construction. Rough estimate is that the vessel could hold about 2,750 pounds of scallops or anything else you can fit in that space. And as an aside, stepping away from my living marine resource enforcement portfolio, and if I put on my homeland security hat, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but spaces like these are things that keep you up at night. So the Dinah Jane was directed back to New Bedford, where she was met by a team of agents from NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement, Homeland Security Investigations, Massachusetts Environmental Police, and the Massachusetts State Police. And I'm deeply grateful to my law enforcement partners for their assistance in this case. In addition to the hidden compartment, the vessel had a 200-pound scallop overage, which was voluntarily abandoned, and the master was cited again for impeding the Coast Guard boarding. The vessel was issued a captain of the port order to refrain from using and concealing the space. The investigation continues, and charges are in the process of being referred to the U.S. Attorney. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, Mr. Chair, in addition to the issues discussed, I showed this slide at the last council meeting to underscore the concern for compliance with fisheries and customs laws, but also for the safety of the crews that operate on these vessels. On the left is a vessel, it's not the Dinah Jane, but similar in construction and size, with the approximate location of the hidden compartment in red. You can see the box there, it's kind of where it is. And again, on the starboard side of the vessel, it's just very simple naval architecture. When you shift weights up high, you shift their center of gravity up high, and you reduce the stability of the vessel, and that contributes to rollovers and capsizings because of these improper loading conditions, and the vessel simply wasn't designed or constructed to handle it. As a result of the second data point, we will continue to put an additional emphasis on full at-sea space accountability to identify any more hidden compartments, mitigate the risk to the fishers' resources, and to prevent dishonest fishermen from gaining an unfair advantage over those who play by the rules. And finally, Mr. Chairman, just a plug for the Enforcement Committee's gear stowage workshop on the 29th of November. Lieutenant Kessler, who's not in the room, but he's the commanding officer of NERF Tech, was kind enough to offer his facility for us to try out and take some practical demonstrations of ways to better stow gear while the vessels transit at closed areas. We look forward to collaborating with industry. It's basically a joint effort between Coast Guard and NOAA and the entire Enforcement Committee to collaborate and find ways to make gear stowage regulations more safe and enforceable. So this concludes my report on recent activities, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions. The ongoing nature of the investigation with the Dinah Jane case, I may not be able to answer all your questions with respect to that situation. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? David.
There we go. It work now? Okay. This isn't a question. It's more a comment. In the Western Gulf of Maine, where I'm from, there's been a resurgence in large boats fishing in the Western Gulf of Maine. Some of the boats are boats that haven't fished there for 15 years. Some of them are boats that have never fished there. As a result, there's been a concomitant loss of fixed gear, quite a large loss here in the last month and a half. And I just wanted to let the Coast Guard know and enforcement know, to remind them that there is a 12-inch rock hopper limit in the Western Gulf of Maine. and that some people may not be aware of the 12-inch limit or may be purposely ignoring it. But when boats lose gear in places they haven't lost it in 15 years, then I would say that chances are the 12-inch limit's being not being adhered to. So it's an issue. The other issue is that this fixed gear this time of year has pingers on it required for harbor porpoise. The gear appears to be permanently lost. I mean, it's been towed multiple miles away and dumped somewhere. But when those pingers go dead, then that gear is going to potentially entangle harbor porpoise. So there's two issues here. It's pretty serious. So I just wanted to call everybody's attention to it.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we will take the 11:15 EFP item, and then we will go to break after that.